Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we will be speaking about Spanish Market, and we'll talk to Mariel Nanasi from New Energy Economy about carbon caps and the Supreme Court and all sorts of good things. I'd like now to welcome to the program Andrew Tillen. He is the author of the new book, The Doper Next Door, My Strange and Scandalous Year on Performance-Enhancing Drugs. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So you are a journalist, you were a bike racer, and at a certain point about 4 or 5 years back, you got the idea to do a magazine article on people who take performance-enhancing drugs and hormones and things like that. What happened next?
Well, I went on a search with the hopes of finding such a regular person, not just I wasn't looking for an elite athlete. There are plenty of elite athletes, pro athletes, amateur athletes in the Olympics who have taken such substances. But as a journalist, I hadn't found a story really about a regular person taking these types of substances. And so I went on a search. I went looking... asking everyone from track and field coaches to pro cycling coaches to bike store owners to fellow bike racers, because I was an amateur bike racer at the time, where I might find leads. And I didn't find too many.
So there's a lot of people who are doing this, but basically no one wanted to talk to you. So you took the extraordinary decision to try these drugs yourself. Why did you do that?
Well, we should back up one step. I can't say for sure that there are lots of regular people doing this, but I believe that, you know, we emulate our heroes in all sorts of ways. We buy their baseball mitts and bats. We wear their uniforms. We buy their soccer cleats and balls. We buy their bicycles. We buy their nutritional products. Why wouldn't we buy their doping products, per se? So I was convinced, not only because I thought we would, because I thought there was this trickle-down theory, but also because I believe that this stuff is accessible and that these drugs are huge temptations to people and huge curiosities. But, you know, in all my bike racing, while I was convinced I raced against other people who were on these drugs, I never knew for sure. So... yes, I did take the extraordinary leap, or the crazy leap, or the sane leap, depending on how you want to characterize it. And I did it carefully. I studied these drugs. I studied sort of hormones and realized that men need hormones too, and that there's a whole group of scientists and doctors and marketing men and probably snake oil salesmen who think that men, as they grow older, need testosterone. And testosterone is not only the male sex hormone, but it is a performance-enhancing substance when taken in supplemental doses. So I went about trying to find a way to acquire testosterone, and there were a couple of ways to do that.
It's funny, when you decided you were going to do this, your wife questioned your motivations and said, look, is this really just about journalism? Talk about those motivations inside of you.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And it was a great question posed to me by my wife and posed to me by one of my best friends. My best friend pretty much put it to me this way: are you writing a book to take drugs, or are you taking drugs to write a book? And the answer, even to this day, is, you know, unclear to me. I can't say it was one or the other, absolutely. I am human. I am getting older. I watched my wife take hormones. She was on replacement hormones as women grow older. There are many women who take who are on what's called HRT, or hormone replacement therapy. Not so much with men, although that's an emerging market and a big market. But I watched her take these drugs. Not testosterone, but female hormones, estrogen and progesterone, and I watched them do amazing things to her, and I sort of thought that there might be a story that follows two tracks. One would be the pursuit of youth. You know, as an older man, I mean, I was in my early 40s, but I could still sort of feel my ability slipping, and certainly my swagger slipping, and my libido ebbing. And as a bike racer, like I said, I was convinced that other people already took these drugs, and I wanted to find out for myself what these drugs actually did. And I wanted to sort of experience this in a full-bodied way, not just, I think there's a lot of stories out there that talk about athletes taking performance-enhancing drugs, and they're usually either accusatory reports or they're defenses. And I just thought there was much more to these drugs, living with them, buying them, feeling bad about them, feeling great about them, a whole spectrum of feelings that might be associated with taking these drugs that I had never read about, and I was curious.
Now, these kinds of drugs are associated with scandals in the world of professional athletics. Are they legal?
Well, some are and some aren't, and depending on who you are and what your malady is. So I am. I walked into doctor's offices as a guy in my 40s. I had blood work done, and I shared my blood work results, of course, with physicians. And there were physicians all over the map. Some looked at these results, particularly at my testosterone levels, and said, huh, you know, you're fine, because I fell within what's sort of a diagnosed range of what a middle-aged man should have in terms of testosterone. Well, it is an enormous range, and it is interpretive. And I was at the very low end of what's called normal. So I went to another doctor, and she said, you are low normal. And she was, in fact, before I went to her, I went to a urologist, and he said I was low normal, and he was willing to give me testosterone. Testosterone, supplemental testosterone, is a $1 billion legal industry in the United States. And I was greedy. I went past the urologist and went to other doctors who are associated with sort of a different medical community other than the traditional one called the anti-aging community. Anti-aging medicine is its own sort of genre of medicine. And there are some doctors that truly believe that men go through their own menopause, called andropause, which I called andropause, conveniently, in my book. And they diagnosed me as low enough on testosterone that they put me on the stuff. And suddenly, you know, I sort of had this really powerful hormone to work with. As a family guy wanting to get some swagger back, and as a bike racer wanting to see what it was like to take a performance-enhancing drug.
We're talking to Andrew Tillon about his book, The Doper Next Door. So talk about this whole culture of anti-aging therapy. I mean, I have to say, as I read your book, it seemed kind of dodgy. What are the doctors and patients and non-doctors like who promote this stuff? What are they looking for?
Well, there is an enormous spectrum, and some of them I have immense amounts of respect for, including the physician that I ultimately worked with. She was a longstanding internist. She had worked in different parts of the country, a traditional doctor with a traditional education in medicine, you know, highly decorated, plenty of degrees, and she had grown tired of prescribing her patients pills, and she had grown tired of the way that she was there basically to respond to symptoms. And she wanted to be proactive in terms of working with the health of her patients. And one way in which the anti-aging community believes that they're different and better than the traditional medical community is that the traditional medical community is often responding to symptoms, whereas the anti-aging community may actually be proactive and attempting to make people feel even better than just sort of standard typical health, which sounds kind of funny and a little dodgy, and it can feel that way. And there are hucksters and scary people who will seemingly prescribe you everything in the moon if you pay them enough money. But the doctor I went to wasn't that way. She prescribed me testosterone very carefully, and she made me have, I had blood work done every 3 months. But yes, this is a community. It's a bit of the Wild West, as one pharmaceuticals industry person related to me in terms of his characterization of the anti-aging community. So it really is this enormous spectrum. And I actually visited with several anti-aging doctors before I found one that I felt comfortable in dealing with.
There's one person whom you describe in the book who is a kind of self-styled guru and writer about anti-aging hormones for both women and men, and a lot of doctors use this protocol. It's called the Wiley Protocol. She doesn't even have a college degree, much less any scientific or medical training. It's very odd.
It is odd. It's curious, and I like Susie Wiley a lot. She's very charismatic, and I think she's very smart, and I think she's very forward-thinking. It is a little scary. She is not an endocrinologist, but she is a very curious woman, and she has applied herself deeply into the sciences. But does that make her a physician? No. I mean, she would be the first to admit that. But it was taking a chance to work with Susie Wiley and the Wiley Protocol. There are a lot of people that believe in Susie Wiley's methods of prescribing, not prescribing, but her suggested protocols for hormone replacement therapy. And there are some people that think she's an absolute nut job and won't go anywhere near her. So I took a flyer with Susie Wiley. And admittedly, one of the reasons that I did and one of the reasons that I wrote this whole book was, I was interested in her because she was charismatic and because she was a character and because I felt like she would be interesting to talk to, and she was very opinionated. And her protocol has been used by the celebrities, many of whom I can't name, but Suzanne Somers is one that I can. Suzanne Somers is big in the hormone replacement therapy industry, and in the anti-aging community, she's a hero, and she has championed Susie Wiley. So Susie does have sort of her big ticket believers. And there are people on the internet who, like I say, are frightened of her and her methods.
Did you consider or study the health risks of what you were doing?
You know, I thought that I covered all my bases. Again, I am not above saying that I'm human, that I make mistakes. I thought that I had a lot of it covered by going to this internist, having my blood work done. But there are lots of dangers to taking these hormones, or I should say lots of unknowns. Unfair to say dangers, but long-term, there are really no studies of healthy populations of men taking testosterone. So take it for 6 months, a year. I almost took it for a year, or I took it, I should say, for almost a year. There's no real knowledge of how that's going to affect the body over time. Obviously, I knew a lot about the short-term effects. So that was one potential negative and scary, you know. I mean, and I did get scared sometimes, and I did wonder what I was doing. And also, there have been many documented cases, or I should say dozens of documented cases of contamination, of testosterone being applied to a man's body and then chemicals rubbing off on towels or women or children or even animals, and having adverse effects on other folks, other organisms, I should say, that weren't in it, that didn't bargain for that, you know. And I have a wife and two children, or I certainly did in 2008 when I had this experience. I still have them, but back then I had them, and they lived with me, and I lived in some fear and tried my best to keep them away from the stuff, the tea.
So what was the experience like for you, emotionally, physically, mentally, the whole thing? What was it like to be on this new drug?
Yeah, well, it was a lot of different things. I mean, you know, that to me was the most sort of, one of the most compelling parts about the whole experience was that it wasn't the same every day, and that I wasn't the same guy every day, and it wasn't just sort of like this light switch that I turned on when I wanted to go faster on my bicycle, and I did go faster on my bicycle because of it. I believe that, although I will also be the first to say that I'm a one-man experiment, and I'm not a scientist, and that this was not a scientific experiment, but I felt like I was on it long enough to enjoy what I felt were real effects. But so one thing I felt was, probably the first thing I felt was an increase in libido, and that is what Susie Wiley and my doctor told me I would feel. Everything from, I don't know how crazy we want to get here on the radio, everything.
It is a family show.
Okay. Yes. So I had, I would wake up feeling very perky, and I basically felt like I was 18 again. And that's sort of a funky feeling when you're 42, 43, and you've been in a relationship with your wife for almost 20 years. You know, you just don't naturally feel that stuff. And so there I was, you know, really just sort of ravenous from a sexual standpoint. And that can be fun. It can be disorienting, too. Swagger, you know, I felt that sort of went along with the libido, was this sort of, things didn't bother me as much in some ways. In some ways, things just didn't bother me. I, you know, small things I could just let go of. And I felt like I had more confidence. And some of that might be placebo effect, too. There's plenty of documentation that that testosterone can have a huge placebo effect, supplemental testosterone. Then there was also edginess. I felt like I was on, sometimes I felt like I was on, you know, 10 cups of coffee, which is not always a great feeling. I would have a short fuse, and it wasn't a matter of getting physical, but it was a matter of getting really perturbed at small things. My son's baseball uniform being too big for him, or arguing with my wife, you know, on a road trip.
You also write about the sense of getting out of your head more, being, I guess, a verbal and mental person, and the drugs seemed to affect you in that way. What did it feel like? You were more in your body?
Yeah, I was more in my body, and my body felt good. It felt strong. You know, I worked out hard. I trained hard in that year. Testosterone, you know, is certainly a drug that doesn't by itself you turn you into a Tour de France rider. What it does, what I believe it does, although there's even controversy here in the sporting community whether or not testosterone might help an endurance athlete, but what I believe it does and what others also believe is that it aids recovery, which means that I would train, and then the next day I could train hard again, and then the next day I could train hard again yet again because I didn't feel, my body wasn't sore, my body wasn't tired, my body wasn't stiff, or as much of those things as it had been previously. So you can just kind of pour on the training, and that's what I did. And I just trained hard, and I trained long, and, you know, I had a coach, and my coach, I had to keep this secret from him, and he was just sort of amazed at my ability to train and my levels of power on my bicycle. Really kind of scratched his head. And so you know, after a while, my body changed, too. Not a lot. I never became Hulk Hogan. That's not my body type. I'm a little guy. I'm 5'8", 143 pounds, or, you know, that's sort of my fighting weight. But I was more muscular, you know, bigger biceps and stronger shoulders and certainly stronger legs. And so, you know, I enjoyed that body. And that literally, you know, made me feel better mentally. And made me feel more confident.
What was it like after the year that you did it when you decided to stop? And there was some hesitation about it, and both you and your wife were thinking, well, do we, you know, we kind of like some pieces of this, but it's time to stop. You stopped, the drug went out of your system, you got back to what? Would you call it normal? How did you feel after you were done with that whole phase?
Yeah, I think that there were several stages of coming off the drugs, and I knew that I had to come off the drugs. I had to come off the drugs, frankly, I had to come off the drugs for the story. I wanted to know what it was like to withdraw and walk away from what in some ways was a can of diet, you know, was a barrel of TNT, and in other ways was a was, you know, youth in a bottle, or youth in a syringe, I should say. And I should add that I did use a syringe, although I used a syringe. Wiley prescribes her protocols through syringes for sort of precision application. But what comes out of the syringe, which is needleless, is a cream, a topical. And I would wipe that on my body twice a day, around my groin area, my lower back, which made it, of course, dangerous in terms of contaminating my wife and children. But back to the question, so I knew I had to come off it. I wasn't sure how I would feel. I read up about how drugs, performance-enhancing drugs, can be addictive, not the way, say, heroin is addictive. It's much more, I think, psychological. If a model can't get too thin, well, you know, a performance-enhancing drug user maybe can't get too muscular. And I didn't want to lose the muscles. And, you know, I didn't want some of the great feelings that I had to go away. And so I tried to go off it a couple times, a couple different ways, and I struggled. And I went back on it, or I didn't taper, as I was told to do, reduce my dosages incrementally. And so I ended up staying on it maybe 2-3 weeks longer than I had designed. And then finally, it just was sort of a cold turkey moment, and I asked a couple of physicians, including mine, and, you know, they didn't say that it was dangerous for me to go off at cold turkey, per se. There was some danger of perhaps me suffering from enlarged breasts, which is really a phenomenon that can happen to steroid users, and that did scare me quite a bit, but I was assured that that wasn't going to be part of what would happen with my particular protocol. And so I finally went off it, and I didn't shrivel like a raisin, but I, over time, just lost that vitality. And I felt weak at first and sort of sickly, and I laughed at my, not didn't laugh, but I saw that my wife had night sweats when she was sort of going through hormonal imbalances, and the same thing happened to me. I suddenly was menopausal all over again.
This book points out to me so many things about American culture, and I don't know how you feel about this, but as I was reading it, I was thinking about the over-identification with sports and strength and performance, and even the phrase sexual performance, you know, as a way of thinking about sexuality in the first place. It's a little strange. And then I couldn't help but feeling that, you know, people who want to be 25 forever or 18 forever, maybe we're really out of touch with the cycles of life, these sort of natural cycles. Maybe it's a cultural deficiency that has negative repercussions. I mean, you have this very nice passage in the book where you talk about how sexuality can be empty if it's just based on that kind of physicality, and you can almost be using each other, and how all of that physicality that you experienced and all the effects of it have nothing to do with love, have nothing to do with soul, with, I mean, when I think about it, with music, with art, with what's beautiful, with connection with people, with compassion. You know, it may even inhibit thinking about those things.
You know, I couldn't agree more. And I'd be the first to say that while I'm very proud of my book, and I think it's a very compelling story, you know, I think it's a balanced story. And I walk away from that experience, you know, the jury is out. You know, Mary Charlotte, it is, the anti-aging community does have sort of a tinge of sadness to it in that they are pursuing this thing that, you know, maybe evolution, God, whatever is dictating our lives out there didn't design this. And there was a certain emptiness to the whole experience. Even my bike racing. After a while, oh, it was really fun. You know, like I said before, I'm not a great bike racer, never was. And I was not a high-ranking bike racer, which was another reason why I felt like it wasn't justified, but I felt a bit better about my experiment because I wasn't knocking anyone, I wasn't taking away anyone's you know, dinner money. And I never won a race, although I tried. And I would rise. I would come to the front of the races, and I would have power and strength and confidence that I didn't have before. And it was a blast. It was a blast to dictate races the way I hadn't previous to taking testosterone. But, you know, after a while, I realized this was just a bike race, and that this was that I was sort of monkeying with the fate of all these other people that had worked very hard to be where they were. I worked hard too, but I sort of had an unfair technology that I was using. So I agree also with your assessments of sex and intimacy and how, youthful sex doesn't make for necessarily fulfilling sex or intimacy, and sexual performance is maybe kind of a funny way to characterize it, and glad you called me on that. I hadn't really thought that through. And so in that way, it was easy to walk away from it. I think at one point in the book, you know, I talk about maybe what I really want out of this whole experience is wisdom. And the interesting thing about this book really is that, sure, it's about taking these drugs. It's about libido. It's about bike racing. But in a lot of ways, it's really a coming of middle age tale. I
right.
believe in your 40s, you have real vision of the world that's now behind you. Your 20s and 30s, particularly if you have children, you can feel mortal very quickly. And also, what's to come? You know, you see parents that are aging, and unfortunately, in my case, my parents are both deceased, but I could sort of see what old age was like. These drugs really helped me to understand where I really was in my life and how these drugs really artificially, occasionally placed me on different places on the timeline, but in reality, it was just, I wouldn't call them a recreational drug, but I would say that, you know, they had sort of that, sort of a nice place to visit, but you wouldn't want to live there effect for me.
Andrew Tillon is author of the book, The Doper Next Door, My Strange and Scandalous Year on Performance-Enhancing Drugs. And he will be tonight at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening, and people can meet him and get a copy of the book. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Donna Padacci. She is director of the Spanish Colonial Arts Society, and she is here because Spanish Market is coming up this weekend, Saturday and Sunday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So let's talk about Spanish Market for a moment. How old is this institution? Tell us a little bit about its history.
Well, Spanish Market is one of the programs of the Spanish Colonial Arts Society. The society is 86 years old, and the first market was held in 1926. But unfortunately, during the late 30s, 40s, early 50s, there was a hiatus for the market itself. The founders of the society had both died, and the other board members had not carried on in that fashion. So it was picked up again in the early 60s, and this is our 60th anniversary. And we're delighted. We think it's going to be full of surprises and lots of fun and wonderful art for the community.
What kind of art was presented in the beginning, and how has that evolved, and how has it kind of stayed the same in the last almost century?
Well, in the original markets, it was primarily the painted bultos and retablos that were used in the various Catholic churches. That was the original art. And from that, artists and scholars have done more research on the historical art that had been done hundreds of years before and up to modern day. And as they scholastically verified the art, it was then added to the art roster. Our market is very unique in that the standards are set by the artists themselves. Not by the society, but by the artist. And the artists agree on what new art forms can be brought into market and also what the standards are for that. They are always required to use the traditional methods and materials. That has been something that's been pretty much unchanged over the years.
In the beginning, I mean, this is the period that you're talking about in the first part of the 20th century, there was a huge attempt to bring tourism into Santa Fe. Was Spanish Market part of that?
No, it was actually sort of the reverse. As a lot of originally, most of the art was created for the Catholic Church. Most villages had a parish. And as we came into the early 20th century, the Catholic Church began closing some of those parishes. And so the market, if you will, dried up. So the artist who had been making the art for the churches had no one to sell to. So the society created the market to provide a venue for the artist to sell their work, to show and sell their work. There were tourists coming in, and they bought the art, which provided income for the artists, so they were able to continue producing it. Otherwise, without a market, the artists were having to actually, many of them, leave the area. They were going south and be working on ranches. They were heading north into Colorado, working in the lumber fields. So the intent was to provide an economic way for the artist to continue making the art.
There must have been then a proliferation of Native New Mexican Hispanic art all over the United States.
In the early days, the collectors did come in. They bought it. They took it home with them wherever they were going. And certainly some of the traditional art has grown up in other communities. But in many states, whether it's Arizona or California, Texas, where there are large Hispanic populations that have been there for many, many years, they also have their own traditions, which sometimes are similar, sometimes different. And so New Mexico does have a very unique art forms, and it's something that is pretty recognizable anywhere you go in the country.
So what is Spanish Market all about today? What are some of the forms of art and genres and techniques that people are using?
Well, we do, of course, still have the bultos, the retablos, the paintings
on
wood.
Tell us what bultos and retablos are.
Bultos are three-dimensional carvings. Retablos are paintings on wood. They are religious in nature because the early Spanish settlers who came into the area, it was the church that brought in the art. And so the religious depiction is the very common theme in Spanish colonial art. We have straw applique, we have micaceous pottery, we have incredible tin work, iron work. I should have brought a list. We have a lot.
Yeah.
Wood carving, furniture, both painted and unpainted.
And you'll have to go and jewelry. See the rest. Right,
jewelry. We have a large selection of art forms, and there's something that would apply to almost anyone's taste.
And so what is the process by which, I mean, I'm not sure I would even want to be at these committee meetings where people decide what does and doesn't qualify as traditional art or as Spanish market-worthy art.
Well, we have a standards committee, and there's also an artist liaison committee, and they work very closely together. For our market, we are the traditional Spanish market. That is our official name. And our greatest concern, and it has been, it was the reason the society was founded, was to do all we could to ensure that the traditional methods and materials, that knowledge would pass from generation to generation, the ability to create that art would be known. And so it's what was the material that was used. It requires quite a bit of research on the part of the artist as well as the standards committee and the artist liaison and our staff.
And what are some of those materials?
They were the native materials available. It was the pine. It was the ponderosa. It was sometimes cottonwood. The natural grasses in the straw applique, for instance, the natural wools in our weavings. I forgot to mention all of our textile work, but the natural wool that's used there, the natural dyes. Many of our artists, particularly the retablo artists, they go out and they find the minerals and the clays, and they grind their own and make their own dyes. It is that ability to do it in the traditional way.
And presumably pigments for paintings as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. The same for the wools. Many of our artists, not all, but many of them also do very contemporary work in other markets. And we love that. We think it's a great expression of their creativity. But our focus is on the traditional so that that heritage is not lost.
To what extent are young people learning these methods and materials, and in what context are they learning them?
In a variety of ways. This year at the market, we will have 58 youth artists. In order to be in our youth market, they must have a mentor, a teacher, who are among our traditional artists. Their mentor has to have been judged into market. And the young people are, they bring their work. It's for sale. It's always a delight. People love the youth market. But families teach it to their children, their grandchildren. And then other young people are able to be taught by the mentors if they don't have a family member who can pass it on. And we have youth art days. We have artists who go into the school systems all over town, the surrounding area, to teach a particular art form among our many. We have Arts Alive during the summer months at the museum that are free and open to the children. So there's a whole variety of ways where they're allowed to have an exposure to it to see if it interests them and they could study further.
We're talking to Donna Padacci, the director of the Spanish Colonial Art Society, about Spanish Market. So what are some of the events that are coming up this year and some of the highlights of this year's Spanish Market?
In terms of a highlight, one thing I would like to mention is that this year we have a new category that I think is going to be very exciting. I know it is for some of the artists, and hopefully it will be for our visitors. It's called Innovations Within Tradition, where the artists have decided that they still have to use the traditional methods and materials, but they're allowed to use the iconography in different ways. And we've had some, it is a juried category, and we have 22 artists who have juried into it. Out of the 197 who will be at market, 22 have juried into this. And I think buyers and collectors will find some really exciting stuff.
What does it look like? Give us some examples.
One of our artists, Arthur Lopez, is doing a piece where he has a saint that is riding on the back of a bee. I'm not sure how that sounds to hear that, but it's just an incredible piece. We have some straw applique that is being done with ostrich eggs that are just gorgeous. One of the saints is placing a call to God to talk about some issues on a cell phone. So they're using the iconography in new and different ways. And we're hoping that it'll be fun for our visitors as much as it is for the artist. As to events that are going on Thursday afternoon from 5:30, we're having a layman's lecture on the saints. It will be held at the Guadalupe Sanctuary. And Marina Ochoa, who is the historian for the Archdiocese of Santa Fe, is giving the talk. And
this is today, Thursday.
That's correct. Thank you. And that's free and open to the public at 5:30. Tomorrow, Friday, we will have our members-only preview party at the Convention Center. It is open to our members. This is probably the biggest single membership benefit, I think. And
and you can join at the door if you're not a member.
You can, and membership starts at only $40. All of the award-winning art will be on display, as well as the artists, so it's a wonderful time to really one-on-one have a chance to see the art and talk to the artist. Then the market itself will start on Saturday, 9 o'clock, run 9 to 5. Sunday morning, we're having our traditional market mass at the cathedral at 8 o'clock, where the Archbishop will bless the artist and the art, and that'll be followed by a procession behind a mariachi band around the plaza, and then the Archbishop will bless the market itself. Then the market will continue through the day.
And it's the 60th annual traditional Spanish market. It's on the plaza. Do people come from all over the place to
people
see this?
from all over the country and overseas. We have serious collectors who are there, and we have local residents who are maybe looking for one more special piece to add to their collection. We have museums who come looking for pieces for their Spanish colonial departments. And it's a fun time. There's music, there's dance, there's traditional foods. It's a very festive thing. There's entertainment going on all day in addition to the incredible art that's on display.
And let's not forget music.
Oh, yes. We have lots of music. And this year we're doing something a little bit different. In addition to the traditional entertainment on the bandstand, we have some entertainers who will be out in the street. So we think we're going to take the music to the visitor, so they don't necessarily have to go to the bandstand.
Excellent. Now, besides all that, people can actually visit the museum.
Absolutely. We have the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art on Museum Hill, 750 Camino Lejo, and it's the only museum in the country, we think the world, that is dedicated to Spanish colonial art, and so we invite any visitors to town or residents to come up. We'll be open from 10 to 5 each day.
It's a very cool place.
Well, I think it's a gem in Santa Fe. It's in a John Gaumin historic building and has some very, very excellent exhibits going on. We have six different exhibits on display right now.
Some of them permanent, some of them rotating?
Yes, we have one permanent display. The rest do change every few months.
Donna Padache is the director of the Spanish Colonial Arts Society at SpanishColonial.org. The museum is on Museum Hill. Spanish Market is on the plaza this Saturday and Sunday. And for more information, you can go to the website, SpanishColonial.org. Donna, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And happy Spanish Market.
Thank you.
We've got just a few minutes left. I would like to welcome to the show Marielle Nanasi. She is the Executive Director of New Energy Economy. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So you are just coming hot off of a victory at the New Mexico Supreme Court yesterday. What happened, and fill us in on the background?
As many of your listeners know, the Environmental Improvement Board adopted our petition to curb greenhouse gas emissions.
Last year,
in 2010, it was a rule then. Then we sought to have it published, as is the normal course, but Governor Martinez stepped in and tried to halt it from being published. We filed a case in front of the Supreme Court then, and got her overturned. We were the first victory against her. And they ruled, hey, she's not above the law, and she's got to publish our rule. But she campaigned against reducing carbon emissions, and she said, I will do anything in my power to get rid of this regulation.
So the stepping even a step back from that, this is all about climate change and carbon pollution, carbon footprint, and basically regulating very large industries. The largest industries in the state of New Mexico, so that they, over the course of years, starting, what, I think,
in
two or 3 years from now.
2013.
Begin to reduce their carbon footprint.
Technically, it's 3% a year below their 2010 levels. And clearly, PNM, who's the largest carbon polluter in New Mexico, they are responsible for more than half of all of carbon pollution that causes global warming, but also, and very significantly...
In the state.
Thank you. But also, significant local pollution. The asthma rates in San Juan area are some of the highest asthma rates in the entire country, and why it's directly related to PNM's coal plant.
Not to mention mercury. There's a lot more we can go into, but we, like I said, we only have a few minutes left. So this rule was published.
And then PNM, rightfully, as is their right, appealed to the appellate court saying they didn't like the rule. And then at first, the very first thing they did was they filed a motion to stay and said, hey, you know what? We think we're going to beat you in the legislature. So appellate court, don't rule on this case yet. And they tried. They filed seven bills to try to repeal the carbon regulation rule. We defended it, and we won. And we actually defended The other, along with a number of other environmental and advocacy organizations, we prevented the rollback of all the environmental protections in New Mexico.
We being our elected officials, elected by the people of the state of New Mexico.
Correct. And then what happened next was New Energy Economy, the stay was lifted in the appellate court, and then New Energy Economy sought to intervene in the appellate court and said, hey, okay, we're here to defend the rule. And the EIB, the new EIB,
that the new Environmental Improvement Board,
that Governor Martinez appointed, and she canned, that was one of the very first things that she did when she became governor, she canned the old Environmental Improvement Board, and she appointed a new Environmental Improvement Board after they ostensibly passed a litmus test saying that they would throw out our carbon rule. And so the PNM and the EIB fought our intervention in the appellate court. And we were like, really? We were a party below. We wrote this rule. We were the petitioner. We actually presented over 200 hours of technical testimony, economic and scientific testimony. And the board found that it was, you know, good for the people of New Mexico, and the appellate court said, no, you can't intervene. So we filed what's called a writ of superintendent control, which is a fancy way of just saying we filed an appeal to the New Mexico Supreme Court saying, hey, we got to participate in this appeal.
Because somebody needs to defend the rule capping carbon pollution.
Exactly. The PNM and EIB are against the rule. Who's there to defend the rule?
It's ironic that the Environmental Improvement Board, which is supposed to improve the environment, was on the same side as the people who are polluting the environment.
Yes, that's a problem. And we alleged collusion. And we said that's why we need to be in the case, because both of the parties were on the same side. And as a matter of fact,
government and industry on the same side? Why, I'm shocked.
And in fact, they started to mediate the case. They did mediate the case, and in fact, they, quote-unquote, agreed to resolve the case, telling PNM, why don't you just go file a new petition in front of us? And we appealed to the Supreme Court, and yesterday in the Supreme Court, there was some really interesting questions by the justices, and the Chief Justice specifically asked, who is going to defend the rule if New Energy Economy is not allowed to intervene? We have an adversarial process here. Before it was environment versus industry. Now there's just industry and the government who are on the same side. And this is like one hand clapping. And New Energy Economy, we were victorious in front of the Supreme Court. They ruled from the bench in a 5-0 unanimous decision that New Energy Economy would be allowed to intervene in the appeal. And therefore, just like you said before, that we are in the position now of being able to protect and preserve the rule on appeal.
So what happens next?
Well, there's going to be more back and forth in the appeals process. We think that we stand a really good chance in the appellate court, because the standard of review is, did the agency abuse its discretion, which we think is the answer is overwhelming no, they didn't abuse their discretion, and was there substantial evidence that was put forth, that was submitted before them? And again, we took a long time. There was lots of public testimony. There was a lot of economic testimony. There was a lot of scientific testimony that said that this rule will benefit New Mexicans.
Marielle Nanasi is Executive Director of New Energy Economy. They're on the web at newenergyeconomy.org. And we hope to have you back for updates as all of this moves forward. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.